Thank you very much. It's great to be here speaking in person. A lot has changed since my colleague Marion Kohler was speaking to the same conference virtually a year ago. While COVID is still around, we've moved on from the most severe health, social, and economic effects of the pandemic. Given the strong economic recovery from the pandemic and the very high rates of inflation in Australia and in many other countries, central banks have significantly tightened financial conditions, increasing interest rates from the ultra-low levels that we had. Today, I want to go over how the Australian RMBS market has evolved against this changing backdrop. RMBS are an important source of funding for Australian lenders. It backs around 70% of mortgages by non-bank lenders and almost 10% for the banks outside of the major banks. So first up today, I'm going to describe some of the policy effects through the pandemic and the effect they had on the RMBS market. And then I'll discuss current conditions before moving on to some forward-looking thoughts. So like many aspects of the Australian economy and financial system, the securitisation market fared much better through the pandemic than many of us might have feared. When markets reacted to the early stages of the pandemic in March 2020, we saw RMBS spreads to bank bill swap rates increase in Australia by around 40 basis points. But this increase was actually pretty modest compared to previous peaks, and it was short-lived. RMBS spreads over the course of 2020 and 2021 declined to the narrowest levels since the GFC. Since before the GFC, in fact. Overall, securitisation markets continue to provide competitively priced funding for Australian non-bank lenders through the pandemic. This was in stark contrast to the GFC. That crisis, of course, originated in subprime lending. But the entire asset class of securitisations was tarred, including more plain vanilla products like Australian RMBS. Back then, secondary market RMBS spreads increased by over 400 basis points as some offshore investors sold their RMBS holdings. Access to funding via securitisation markets back then was impeded for issuers, and the market continued to need the support of the AOFM for several years. There were two key differences between the pandemic and the GFC that led to these different outcomes. First of all, the recent health shock was external to the financial sector. And second, post-GFC reforms had made the financial sector much more resilient. Had the financial system been as fragile as it was back in 2007, the consequences of the pandemic would have even been much more severe for the economy than we've experienced. In 2020, our financial system has been well placed to absorb rather than amplify the pandemic shock. Banks' funding profile and liquidity management were much more resilient, having benefited from important reforms in the wake of the GFC. We also saw unprecedented levels of policy support in Australia during the pandemic, from national and state governments, as well as the Reserve Bank and others. These actions helped to limit the initial downturn and restore economic activity quickly. By supporting the Australian economy more broadly, the suite of policies that were also assisted securitisation markets, but some of those policies had a much more direct impact on securitisation. The policy with the most immediate effect on securitisation was the Structured Finance Support Fund. That was introduced by the AOFM, by the government, and implemented by the AOFM to support small lenders. The AOFM was able to invest in a range of securitisation products. And these investments were designed to support continued private investment in the market. And that provided small lenders with access to reasonably priced finance. The structure of this program was broadly similar to the support offered to securitisation in the GFC, But there were some important differences. While the $15 billion announcement of the size of the SFSF was larger than initially available for the GFC support, the actual investments during the pandemic turned out to be much smaller and over a much more short time frame than in the GFC. The SFSF had a broad investment mandate. It allowed the AOFM to invest in both primary and secondary markets, as well as private warehouses. And this included a forbearance SPV that helped non-bank lenders to offer repayment deferrals akin to those being offered by banks. It was also able to support any part of the capital stack other than the first loss notes. This was significantly broader than the investment mandate of the GFC support program. The breadth of the SFSF enabled the AOFM to fill gaps being left by private investors. Mezzanine tranches of both term deals and warehouse transactions were a particular focus. The speed of implementation of this program enabled a restoration of conditions in the securitisation market very quickly. Many of the policy actions taken by the Reserve Bank during the pandemic worked to lower the structure of interest rates in Australia. This, of course, included the initial reduction in the cash rate, but also the term funding facility, which provided low-cost funding to banks, a yield curve target and forward guidance, as well as the bond purchase program. As a result, yields fell to historically low levels and for all debt funding instruments. By the end of 2020, RMBS spreads to BBSW were the lowest they had been since before the GFC. Narrower RMBS spreads were following market moves more broadly, but they were further supported by investor demand for RMBS and a search for yield, as well as few other alternative investment products. Demand for RMBS was also boosted by significant reduction in banks' issuance of senior unsecured bonds. This encouraged some investors to purchase RMBS, which can offer a broadly similar credit risk as they also have exposure to Australian households and the housing market. Senior unsecured bond issuance slowed because banks had ample access to other sources of funding, in particular coming from the TFF, which gave them low-cost three-year funding, and also very significant deposit inflows. A difference between the pandemic and the GFC was the broad policy measures affecting bank funding during the pandemic supported the demand for RMBS, while arguably this was not the case during the GFC. Banks not only had reduced issuance of senior bonds through the pandemic, but also their issuance of RMBS. Leading up to the pandemic, the major banks didn't often issue RMBS. They had other cheaper sources of funding, and so only issued RMBS occasionally to maintain some connection with investors. Regional banks tended to issue RMBS more frequently, given they have more expensive and restricted access to capital markets than the major banks. Non-bank RMBS had already been increasing as a share of issuance for several years, and this picked up through the pandemic. Recently, non-bank issuance has been almost $10 billion per quarter, several times the volume of issuance just 5 years earlier. And non-bank issuance of securities now accounts for around half of the outstanding stock of RMBS. This has implications for the characteristics of the RMBS stock. Non-bank RMBS typically have lower average seasoning and a higher loan-to-valuation ratio than the RMBS issued by banks. By earlier this year, securities markets were beginning to resemble more normal conditions. Spreads had widened from their COVID lows and were approaching the pre-pandemic levels. Issuance volumes were very strong in the first quarter of this year, and have remained fairly strong throughout the rest of the year. This year has also seen bouts of market volatility. Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February led to an increase in risk aversion, which slowed the flow of RMBS issuance for a little while. Some deals were downsized, and market volatility was cited as a factor in one bank RMBS deal being withdrawn from the market after launch. And reportedly, joint lead managers also provide substantial support to deals during this period. Given this market instability, banks increased their issuance of covered bonds. Covered bond issuance this year so far exceeds $35 billion, and that's already the second highest annual total since the first issuance of covered bonds in Australia. This might reflect the desire to replenish covered bond stocks, which had declined over the pandemic period. Banks typically keep their covered bond issuance at around half of the maximum allowed by APRA. Maintaining headroom under this cap means they have the option to increase their covered bond issuance during periods of uncertainty. Market Liaison has suggested that the banks might have preferred to issue covered bonds rather than RMBS this year, as pricing for those covered bonds has been more favourable and it uses the same type of collateral. There was more volatility in late September, this time starting in the UK gilt market, following the UK government's mini budget. Some UK defined benefit pension funds needed to raise cash to meet their margin calls. One of the assets that were sold in large volumes was Australian RMBS, often those securities with very short maturities. This selling was actually met by good demand, with the RMBS market in Australia, the secondary market, providing greater liquidity than many had anticipated. Rising interest rates are also affecting securitisation markets. Higher interest rates reduce the performance of the underlying collateral of housing loans. At the same time, housing prices have been falling and the unemployment rate is expected to rise. And so arrears on home loans are likely to increase also. But there are several factors that support the outlook for RMBS collateral. Housing prices may have declined, but they're still 20% higher than they were prior to the pandemic. And the unemployment rate is starting from its lowest level in around 50 years. And what's more, arrears rates are currently also around record lows. Rising interest rates can affect securities very directly themselves, even though these RMBS are floating rate securities. Rising interest rates can see investors prefer shorter tenor securities, and the steepness of the short end of the yield curve also presents a challenge for many RMBS investors. Many benchmark their performance relative to 3-month BBSW, while the RMBS is paying a spread over 1 month BBSW. The past few years have reinforced just how quickly economic and financial conditions can change. So I'd be really foolish if I was going to make bold predictions, but I do want to just take you through a few more predictable upcoming developments and how they might affect securitisation markets. One change that we do know is coming is the wind down of the committed liquidity facility to zero at the end of this year. The CLF was introduced in Australia in 2015 because there was insufficient high-quality liquid assets for the Australian banks to meet their liquidity coverage ratios that came in the new Basel III standards. With the increase in government debt outstanding, the CLF is no longer required. Another upcoming change is that the TFF funding will mature over the next couple of years. The wind down of the CLF and the maturing of the TFF funding might affect banks' securitisation market activities through both their role as issuers and investors. As issuers, it's possible that the banks might need to issue additional RMBS to fund their purchases of HQLA and to replace their funding of their financing from the TFF. But given banks have many sources of funding available, including deposits, whether they choose to issue RMBS will ultimately depend on the relative cost of funding. The primary collateral type that banks hold for the TFF and the CFF is self-securitizations. All else equal, the upcoming changes to these facilities will reduce the bank's needs to hold self-securitizations, although this reduction will be slightly offset by LCR guidance from APRA that stipulates minimum holdings of self-securitizations. If the stock of self-securitizations decreases, banks would have more mortgages on their books, which enable them to issue RMBS. But the effect of this is probably likely to be small, given that the availability of mortgages is rarely a constraint for banks issuing RMBS. On balance, a more important driver of issuance will again come back to the cost of different sources of funding and some decisions around funding diversity. As investors, banks hold a small amount of marketed RMBS as collateral for both the CLF and TFF. As the CLF is wound down and the TFF funding matures, banks might find they have less need to hold these securities and so reduce their demand. But our liaison indicates that this hasn't happened so far. One growing specialty area of securitisation is the issuance of green RMBS. Australian green-labelled securitisation has hit a record high in the first half of 2022. As a share of total domestic securitisation, green issuance in Australia frequently exceeds that in both the United States and the European Union. A green RMBS is made up of green loans, but what is classed as green can be quite broad and is at the discretion of the issuer. It could be that the loans are for high energy rating properties or for properties with particular features such as solar panels. Issuers often attain a third-party certification that the mortgage is green, but they can also rely on self-designated criteria. This approach to green classification of taking a market-determined approach is in line with practice in the United States, but differs from that in the European Union, where a taxonomy prescribes what is green activity. For green RMBS in Australia, it is essentially up to the investors to interpret the declarations made by the issuer. It's good to see that in Australia that the Securitisation Forum and industry are working in this area. As we've seen with securitisation markets more broadly following the GFC, improved disclosure and greater consistency improves the investor confidence and so the size of the investor base. An interesting development will be to see how green criteria in Australia evolve and interact with those definitions used in other markets. Tomorrow is the 1st of December, which my kids will take as being able to mean that they can play Christmas carols. But it's actually an important day for many other reasons. As announced by the RBA last year, floating rate notes and marketed asset-backed securities issued on or after tomorrow that reference BBSW must include robust fallback provisions if they want to be eligible as collateral in the Reserve Bank's liquidity operations, including our open market operations. Financial market regulators globally have been urging market participants to make financial products more robust by including fallbacks that apply if the referenced benchmark rate is discontinued. If there's one thing that LIBOR has shown us, it's that we shouldn't take existing benchmarks for granted. BBSW is currently a robust benchmark, but that could change, and so it's important that we have those robust fallbacks. The ASF and AFMA have developed template language to include in deal documentation. We've engaged with both industry bodies as they've developed these templates, and we see these final versions that they've produced as meeting the requirements for a robust fallback. So thank you to everyone who's been involved in determining those. A final topic of note relates to upcoming changes to the treatment of self-securitisation as collateral. As self-securitisation is not traded in the market, the Reserve Bank determines the value of those securities using an internal model. This model captures the behaviour of spreads in secondary markets for asset-backed securities as a key input. Back in March 2020, when there was substantial volatility in markets, the bank decided to freeze the modelled prices on self-securitised RMBS for 3 years to mitigate the impact of price volatility on collateral volumes and margining frequency. This policy was beneficial during the period of high volatility and uncertainty. But with improved economic and financial market conditions and the end of that 3-year period, the bank is planning to unfreeze those prices early next year. Based on current market conditions, this is expected to generate margin calls for some TFF borrowers. Summing up, the past couple of years have been pretty eventful for all of us. It's pleasing to be back in the room in person, and that shows that we are moving on from the worst stages of the pandemic. It's also pleasing to see that the securitisation market played its role in a resilient financial system, supporting the economic activity and mitigating the impact of the pandemic. This reflects improvements in securitisation market that followed the GFC and various pandemic-era policy measures. The coming period will see further unwinding of these support measures that have served their purpose, as well as the development of new measures designed to make securitisation even more robust. Importantly, the securitisation market will continue to see innovation. Time will tell what that innovation may be, but it could be that back here in future conferences, we're standing up and talking about the role that securitisation is playing in greening the financial system. Thanks for your attention. I'm happy to take questions.
Jonathan, thank you for that. There are a few questions that have come through. These are jumping around a little bit. The first one here, what is the RBA's view of implementing risk-free rates in Australia in the near future? You touched on that, but you were talking more about fallback. How about implementation?
The implementation of
risk-free rates. I think the question would refer to an alternative to BBSW.
Right. Okay. That's obviously something that the Reserve Bank has been involved in, but we're very happy to be to listen to the market to that and see what market interpretations are. I mean, obviously, a useful fallback is OIS, overnight index swap rates. The cash rate is a market that we see a determined price, so that's a reasonable benchmark. But you know, obviously, there can be others that market can determine.
Okay, thank you. Another question. You noted that the AOFM's market intervention in 2020 was broader than post-GFC. How might future AOFM support further evolve its approach, if at all, if it was ever needed?
Okay, well, let's start with let's hope it's never needed. I think we're all much happier if the market is working well and functioning and there isn't any support from government needed. The support was designed very much to keep private sector participation involved. So, you know, a crucial difference I think we saw between the GFC and the pandemic period was in the GFC where the support from the AOFM was investing in the AAA rated securities, and that was sort of almost crowding out private sector investment. Whereas this time round, the AOFM was able to invest more broadly across the capital stack, and so that could bring private sector investors still into the securities. And the AOFM was, I think, also very tactical in how it was investing. and a primary aim of it was to ensure that there was market participation and to be able to gradually phase out if as that was available. So, you know, I think this is obviously not my domain, and this is something that, you know, the government and the AOFM would determine. But I think we can broadly take some lessons, you know, in the same way that we learnt from the GFC about the impact of various market measures. We've learnt from the pandemic era on the impact of market measures. You know, so, and I would imagine that the government and AOFM would continue to learn if they did face that situation again. But as I said, fingers crossed, we don't need it.
Thank you, and I agree with that. There's a couple of questions on collateral of one form or another, following your comments. So the first one, has consideration been given to allowing RMBS and covered bonds to be included as HQLA2 in a similar way to other jurisdictions such as Canada, UK and Europe?
At the moment, there isn't any plan to change the definitions of HQLA. That's broadly a decision for APRA in terms of what is classified as high-quality liquid assets for meeting various liquidity requirements. There is, you know, we've responded to market conditions in deciding that there's ample HQLA to wind down the CLF. So we are continuing to respond to market conditions, but at this stage, I don't think there's anything that APRA are looking at changes.
Okay, thank you. Somewhat connected, collateral freed up by the requirement for less self-securitization RMBS could go into covered bonds. Should the limit on encumbrance from covereds be adjusted?
I think you've got a speaker from APRA later today, so a lot of these questions are probably better focused to her. Look, I think, you know, covered bonds are used more broadly, say, in Europe than they are in Australia. One of the very strong things we have in Australia is depositor preference. And part of the reason for having a limit on the issuance of covered bonds in Australia is to ensure that you're not encumbering many assets that are on the bank's balance sheet, so that there are still a large quantity of assets on the bank balance sheets to ensure that that depositor preference is well-based. So we don't have paid for insurance on deposits in Australia, as you do have in some other jurisdictions. But there is that government guarantee or effective guarantee up to $250,000. You know, we want to limit the chances that the government could ever be liable for, or actually that would fall back to the banking system, I should say. But, you know, we want to make sure that even if there was a problem with a bank, there's ample assets on the bank's balance sheet to cover depositor preference. So that's essentially the reason why. But if you've got further questions about that, take it up with APRA this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you. A lot of these questions are actually probably could be directed at APRA, so maybe next time we should have both of you there together.
You're just warming up for APRA this afternoon.
Yeah, that's right. So we had a couple of questions on ESG. The first, which you've kindly talked about. Do the regulators have any intention to support ESG issuance, such as concessional liquidity or capital requirements?
So this is something that different countries and jurisdictions are taking a different approach to. In Australia, we've tried to be agnostic about different types of securities and treat everything on a risk basis and a liquidity basis, so that, you know, the types of haircuts that we impose at the RBA are very much based on risk. And equally, when it comes to APRA's determination, they're very much based on liquidity and risk. So we think that's the most appropriate way to deal with this. It is, of course, relevant that ESG can start feeding into credit risk. So we can easily imagine that if we think there is going to be a transition in the Australian economy, as there will be globally, and there are physical and risks coming from climate change, then those will feed through directly into credit risk. So we think that ultimately those ESG factors will actually feed through, and it will be important for the market and ratings agencies to be cognizant and aware of what the impact of ESG factors are having on the credit quality and liquidity of securities. So we think there that, you know, things like disclosure are going to be really important for ensuring that those factors do come through into pricing of securities, as well as their credit risk and acceptance in the market.
Again, there are actually a lot of questions here now, but we've probably got time just for one more if we could trouble you with that. With wider margins between bank senior wholesale debt and RMBS, is the RBA concerned about a future reduction in competition in the lending sector, especially in less well-served sectors?
So we've actually seen very strong competition in, you know, the housing market, which is where most of securitisation is supporting in Australia. Recently, we've actually seen a lot of issuance of ABS outside of RMBS as well. The share of lending that's done by non-bank lenders, who are the main beneficiaries of RMBS issuance, has actually increased in recent time, with the growth of housing credit from non-bank lenders well exceeding that of bank lenders. And so we think there's actually been pretty good competition coming from those bank lenders, non-bank lenders, who are the recipients of RMBS funding. So it actually looks pretty good there.
Well, I think, as I say, there are plenty more questions for both you and APRA. But thank you very much for turning up today and speaking to us. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks very much.